¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, Brexit negotiator says touring issues aren't his problem. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Andy.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when the Fabric nightclub in London announced that it will be reopening after a year and a half closed at the end of this month. But you will not be able to document your return to clubbing if you go there.
Yeah, if you have been spending the last year and a half nearly missing going out and seeing shows and going clubbing and doing all of that sort of stuff, and if at the back of your mind you've been thinking, oh, if only I could go and see a band play or go to a club night and see some DJs and dance and do the clubbing thing. If only I could do all of that. But most importantly of all, the single most important thing that you're desiring to do is to take photographs of you doing that, then Fabric will not be the place to go when it hopefully reopens later this month.
Yes, because they've banned photography, or at least unauthorized photography. If you want to go and ask them, maybe they'll say you can do it. But I think that they're only going to be authorising professional photographers who have been hired to take good pictures. And your crappy pictures of you and your mates sticking your tongues out are not allowed.
Now, in recent years, there have been some bands, haven't there? And indeed, some venues or gig venues that have tried to ban people taking photos or filming videos, because of course in the smartphone age, it's become so much more common at shows for at least 22% of the audience to be holding up their cameras at least 22% of the time, taking bad photos and recording shoddy footage of the gig they're watching, much to the annoyance of normal people standing behind them who now have their view of the stage blocked by somebody's camera.
Yeah, I mean, it just, every time I see a picture of a gig, as much as I'd like to go back to gigs and see live music, anytime you see a picture of like a big show, you just see like the entire like first 20 rows are just standing there with their phone in the air. And it's, I don't want to go back to that. Surely we can get past that now and decide that's not a thing. But obviously in a nightclub, although Fabric do have live shows, and so that would maybe be an issue, I think this is more about, well, they said it was about making sure people stay in the moment and don't pull themselves out of it by whipping their phone out. I mean, there's also the issue of you're in a club taking pictures of your mates, you're probably also going to take pictures of other clubbers as well, who might not want you taking pictures of them, particularly if you're going to start putting them on social media. And maybe, you know, they're a little bit worse for wear, having, I don't know, been for a half pint beforehand or something.
Something like that.
People in clubs often have a half pint before they go in there, and that's often a problem for them.
They've drunk a little bit too much bottled water and it's starting to show. And I suppose when people are taking footage of a live show on stage, although it's annoying for other people because it's blocking their view, in terms of other audience members, what you're probably getting is a bunch of silhouetted heads and not a lot more. Whereas, yeah, in a club, often when you're taking photos around the club, even if up front it's your mates sticking your tongue out, if that is what you'd prefer, it seems to be implying that that was what you were expecting from these photos earlier, But there'll be other people around. It's quite hard to take those photos without getting other people. And maybe those other people would rather not have their nighttime pursuits documented on other people's social feeds. They're not the first club anywhere to introduce this policy, although it isn't that common here in the UK.
No, it seems to be pretty routine in Germany. But over here, yeah, it's still quite unusual. And they're still, I don't know, when, you know, whenever you talk about people taking photos at gigs, you know, you get a lot of people who say, yeah, I hate that. And a lot of people saying, it's my right to take photos of shows so that I can remember them later. So when you just remember it, just remember the show, be there. And what you like, you know, if you're looking at a photo you took, you're not really remembering it, are you? You're just remembering that time you looked at your phone while you were at a gig.
But whichever side of that debate you stand on, please take note, if you are planning to return to clubbing after the COVID lockdown via the London Club Fabric, you will not be allowed to take photos. And if anyone does take photos, I think, I don't know, they're going to smash your phones, hammer you on the head, lock you up in a basement. I don't know. Did they actually say what the sanctions were for people who broke the rules?
I don't know, but I'm sure. I mean, that sounds quite lenient, if anything.
Any of the above might be employed. So please take note of that. But also, while you're taking note of that, take note of this, which is that this fabric photo ban nonsense is not what we're here to talk about this week.
No, later on we'll be discussing Spotify bragging that it's now got some friends on board in the music industry to talk up. It's quite controversial, I think it's fair to say, discovery mode. But first, do you remember that time Boris Johnson got the Conservative Party re-elected as the governing party in the UK, basically by saying, if you vote for me, I'm going to get Brexit done and we'll never have to talk about it again. And how long ago was that now?
That was quite some time ago.
Yeah. And we're not only talking about Brexit still, I would argue that Brexit is not done.
Late 2019, I think we were promised that a vote for Boris Johnson's Conservative Party would get the Brexit deal done, and then Brexit would happen, and we could all move on into a bold new world. And we can all move on into a bold new world, providing we're happy to live in a bold new world where it costs more money to buy stuff in the UK. It's a nightmare selling stuff to people beyond the UK. And British artists can't tour Europe without filling out 8,000 forms, paying £8,000 and having completely unviable touring projects. Providing we're willing to accept all of that and about 6,009 other downsides, Brexit is done and we can all move on.
Sausages are all right at the moment though, aren't they?
There is something about sausages. I've not really been paying attention to that story.
No, I don't eat meat, so I just, you know, well, I don't care about sausages. I don't mind. That's fine. If Brexit's all about sausages, I don't care.
It's not all about sausages. From a CMU setlist perspective.
Oh, yeah, of course. I remember now.
It's all about whether or not British artists will be able to tour the rest of the European Union once COVID restrictions lift. At the moment, obviously, no one can tour because of COVID. But let's hope that fuller capacity shows become possible in the UK and elsewhere in Europe in the next month or so, and then international travel restrictions start to lift, so that by the autumn, at least within Europe, artists can start to tour again. And of course, we should stress, put a bit of balance here. We're not suggesting that because the UK is no longer a member of the European Union, British musicians and artists can't play shows in other European countries. Of course they can. But the key point is, pre-Brexit, as a British artist, touring across the European Union mainly involved getting in a van and driving to another country in the EU, finding a venue and performing. That's what touring involved. Whereas because the UK is no longer a member of the European Union, and because specific provisions to allow visa-free touring across the EU for British performers were not included in the post-Brexit trade deal negotiated by the UK and the EU, when artists start touring the continent again post-COVID, in a number of key EU countries, they will have to navigate new bureaucracy, maybe get travel permits for them and their crew, carnets for their kit and equipment. And then there's the so-called cabotage rules, which impact on when you're having vehicles driving around the continent. Basically, there'll be a whole load of new rules and regulations to adhere to, new paperwork to fill out in a bunch of European countries. That is going to take time. It's going to cost money. And although in theory artists can carry on touring the continent of Europe, all that new bureaucracy and the costs associated with it will make a bunch of British artists' European tours commercially unviable.
Yeah, now, of course, another thing that Boris Johnson and the Conservative Party were saying when they were trying to win successfully the last general election, as well as getting Brexit done, was that they had an oven-ready deal. So basically, it was like, vote for the Conservatives. We've got a deal ready to go. First day after we win that election, we're just going to go over to the EU, sign the deal, everything's done. Except that the deal wasn't oven ready, whatever that even means. And actually, it was kind of agreed right at the last minute. And as you say, that deal did not contain any provisions for visa-free touring for UK artists, despite promises made throughout the process by the government to the music industry that those provisions would be in there, absolutely guaranteed, definitely not a question. And because this deal came so late, it obviously didn't give the music industry very much time to respond to it and say, where's all that stuff you said was going to be in here before that deal came into force? Luckily, we've got a pandemic, which is stopping touring anyway, so that's fine. And that gave the government plenty of time to come and sort it out, which, to be fair, they said they would. And currently have not. But why we're talking about this week is because last week, the man who was in charge of negotiating that deal, Lord David Frost, finally went before a Culture Select Committee hearing to answer questions on what exactly went wrong with the touring provisions in the deal and what exactly the government was going to do about it. And it was important that we heard from David Frost, because when Boris Johnson got up in Parliament a few months ago and said, we are absolutely going to fix this, he then said, David Frost is sorting it out right now. It's all going to be fine. So David Frost turned up at the Select Committee hearing and presumably said, oh yeah, I've got it all sorted. Don't worry about it, mate. All fine. That's what happened.
Well, it would have been good if that is what he had told the Culture Select Committee of Parliament last week, particularly as he was meant to appear before the Culture Select Committee of Parliament a few weeks ago, and he pulled out at the last minute. So getting this update is getting ever more pressing, but that delay wouldn't have been as big a problem had he had a decent, tangible update to give. But in the end, no, he didn't really. In fact, in a way, pretty much any edition of Setlist since the start of the year, we could have talked about this, and quite a few editions we did. And we could have talked about the fact that the music industry says this is a big problem and that the UK blames the EU for there not being provisions in the deal and the EU blames the UK, but that ministers and MPs all agree, including Prime Minister Boris Johnson, that this needs to be addressed and therefore things are going to happen so that by the time the COVID restrictions lift, everything will be fine, except that despite all of those claims and commitments by government, clearly nothing is happening. While that is what we could have said on pretty much every edition of Setlist since the start of the year, thanks to David Frost showing up this time and answering questions of the Culture Select Committee, we can actually confirm, we have government confirmation that pretty much nothing has happened and that when those COVID restrictions lift, even if it takes another 3, 4, 5, 6 months even to get proper European touring back as a result of COVID, it isn't looking likely that these new bureaucratic barriers that artists are facing are going to be dealt with in time for when those tours resume.
Yeah, now, despite the fact that, I mean, David Frost negotiated this deal and more recently in Parliament, Boris Johnson has said he is now sorting out the touring issues. When it came to he actually didn't say, yes, that's my responsibility and I'm sorting it out. He kind of put the responsibility on various other people in government and the music industry itself. I mean, he specifically said that it is the responsibility of the DCMS, that's the Department for Digital Culture, Media and Sport, to take this forward with our embassies, which doesn't sound like he's really doing very much at all.
Now, the general sense you got was he wasn't even really sure why he had to show up to this Culture Select Committee hearing, because it wasn't really anything to do with him. The fact that there was no pan-European provision for visa-free touring in the trade agreement, that was just inevitable because of the government's priority to get rid of all forms of freedom of movement, and given what the EU were saying regarding how you might be able to get a provision for visa-free touring. That wasn't going to work because of the government's policies and priorities. So it just wasn't going to happen. There's nothing we can do about that. And yes, the Department for Culture and individual embassies, particularly in those countries like Spain, for example, where lots of British artists usually tour and where there are some particularly tedious bureaucratic requirements now that we're not part of the EU. Yes, culture. Yes, the embassies should be doing something about that. At some point, maybe, possibly, it would be nice if they could. This isn't my responsibility. This has nothing to do with me. I mean, I'm paraphrasing slightly of what Lord David Frost, chief Brexit negotiator, now a member of the cabinet, told the MPs of the Culture Select Committee last week, but only slightly.
Yeah, although his line was kind of, we can't sort this out with the EU as a whole, you're going to have to do it on a country-by-country basis, he did concede that there were issues resulting from the Brexit deal that couldn't be done on a country-by-country basis. And that's due to what are known as cabotage rules, which impact on the touring of equipment around Europe. And that is a matter for the EU as a whole. And he did have an answer for that, and it was that the Department of Transport is going to sort that out. It's nothing to do with him. Not his problem. He's got nothing to do with it. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, this is a problem for culture. It is a problem for transport. It is not, and we can't stress this enough, a problem for Lord David Frost, despite Boris Johnson saying that it was very much his problem and he was the man to sort it out.
So while he was suggesting all of this wasn't his problem and he didn't need to be asked about it, he did have a suggestion for what could be done, and that was that the music industry could just try a bit harder to persuade EU countries to reduce the red tape and costs of touring for British performers. It's the music industry's problem. They need to sort it out.
Yeah, and Elton John's name came up a few times for various reasons, partly because Elton John has become very vocal on this issue in recent weeks and calling on the government to sort this out, basically saying that while for artists like Elton John, while it's annoying that he will have to get travel permits and equipment carnets for him and his crew and his kit, he can hire people to do that, and there is enough profit margin in an Elton John tour that if he has to do that, he will do it. But of course, what he is saying is, but you don't have to go very far down the hierarchy of touring artists to get to musicians who do not have those sorts of profit margins and can't simply just hire people and pay all of those fees. And so it's going to be a big problem for those artists, is what Elton John has been saying. And he's written op-ed pieces about this in the newspapers. At the last Culture Select Committee hearing on this issue, the one where David Frost was meant to speak, but he didn't show up, a statement was read out from Elton John to that effect. So he's also been quoted in Parliament on this before. And actually, while most representatives for the music industry and for music industry trade organisations have not yet managed to get a one-on-one meeting with David Frost, which is one of the reasons why they were heavily anticipating this session to actually hear from the man himself, the one person in the music industry who has managed to get a meeting with David Frost is Elton John. So not only has Elton talked about this in the press and been quoted in Parliament, he has had a meeting where he expressed his concerns directly to David Frost, but it seemed to be that what Frost's response now was, well, going back to what you were just saying, kind of the opinion, well, maybe Elton John should go and complain to the Spanish rather than the British government and get this sorted out directly, seemed to be one of the things that he was saying.
Yeah, you might think, okay, David Frost might not have heard the previous statement from Elton John at the Select Committee because he didn't turn up. He might not be reading quotes in interviews with Elton John about what he's been saying on this subject, but he has directly spoken to Elton John about it, so he does know what Elton John's stance is. So it was a bit odd that in the hearing last week, he kind of misunderstood, possibly intentionally, what that stance was, and basically said, I don't know what Elton John's complaining about. It's not like he didn't have hits before the European Union was a thing. He can have hits again. It's all fine for him. Which, of course, I mean, Elton John's stance is, it's all fine for me. I've made my money. I continue to make money. But younger artists coming up now are going to find it a lot harder to build an audience by touring across Europe and playing to more and more people in larger crowds every year, doing the European festival circuit, all of which has, that whole system has really, really grown over the 40 years since the European Union and its forerunner has existed. And that's now an essential, or was an essential, part of the British music industry, which politicians are always very keen to point out is a world-leading music industry. It's one of the biggest in the world. British artists are some of the most successful and best known in the world. And that's because this system has existed for so long for British artists to build up their names and their profiles and get their music out there, which it kind of looks like has just been thrown away. And now very little is being done to sort that out, even though it's politicians who frequently point out how important that system is.
Yeah, and lots of people pointed out when Frost said that, well, Elton had hits before the EU or the UK joined the forerunner of the EU. What's he talking about? And of course, you know, as you say, almost certainly deliberately missing the point that since the 1960s, touring has become so much more important for the British music industry at every level. It's a really important revenue stream. And also at a sort of lower level, it's really important for building an audience. And in the streaming age, in the digital age, the opportunity for British music is increasingly global and building an audience beyond the UK. But actually, to truly capitalize on those opportunities, you need to get out and play in those other countries. Europe is, you know, the biggest touring market for British artists for simple geographic reasons. And also there's a huge appetite for UK music in Europe. So, yeah, I mean, almost certainly he was deliberately misunderstanding what Elton was saying. But I don't think, well, interesting, isn't it? Certainly the members of the Select Committee were not impressed with his answers. I think that was very clear. Yeah. And nobody in the music industry was very impressed with his answers. Elton John definitely would not have been impressed with his answers. So in some ways, a total failure of an appearance, except in some ways, was David Frost the winner? Because it was pretty clear he didn't care that the Culture Select Committee was not impressed with his answers, and the music industry are not impressed with his answers, and that Elton John is not impressed with his answers because he got Boris Johnson the end of freedom of movement. He managed to put up barriers to stop those pesky Europeans from coming here. We got control of our borders, and that's all that matters. And the music industry can go fuck itself. Basically, as I say, we are paraphrasing slightly, but I think only slightly, what was said in Parliament last week. Obviously, as it's looking likely, finally, that COVID restrictions are going to start to lift. I mean, it was clear from the start of the year that it was going to be at least a few months before European touring became viable again. As it turns out, it's 6, maybe even 9 months. But as you said, it was the one upside of COVID, in that when we got this last minute trade deal and all of these problems, at least it was like, okay, well, in normal times, this would have been a disaster from the 1st of January, but we've got this buffer period. And so it's the one upside of COVID. Let's use that buffer period. And ministers, including Boris Johnson, were like, yeah, we will. It's now really clear from the man himself, it ain't happening. And it is becoming really pressing, because it does look like finally touring across Europe is going to be possible in the next few months. And we really need, well, assuming that a pan-EU solution isn't viable and isn't going to happen anytime soon, we need to get these, you know, two-way deals between the UK and Spain and the UK and other countries where there are bureaucratic barriers. We need to get those sorted ASAP. There also needs to be support, you know, both administrative support, financial support, information for artists who are going to have to navigate all of this. These things all need to happen like tomorrow. And obviously, the music industry has been calling for this ever since the start of the year, although there is now a new, more formal campaign that was launched in the middle of last month, making 4 big demands of what we need. And whether it's Boris Johnson or David Frost, or maybe somebody mildly competent within government who delivers on those 4 things, doesn't really matter. It just needs to happen.
Yeah, so these 4 immediate actions that are being called for by the Let the Music Move campaign are an urgent transitional support package to cover new and additional costs for touring artists and crews in the EU, measures to overcome restrictive cabotage rules on UK vehicles touring Europe, a viable long-term plan for artists and crew to continue working in all EU 27 countries without costly permits and bureaucracy, and a commitment to ensure European artists have reciprocal freedoms and access to perform at UK venues and festivals. All of which, I think David Frost made clear, are not on the way anytime soon. I mean, in many ways, maybe David Frost is actually quite admirable Are you ready for this argument? In that, I mean, we've had 6 months of politicians all the way up the government, up to Boris Johnson, saying this is an incredibly important issue and it needs to be fixed very, very soon. We understand that. But then if David Frost comes out and gives like what is clearly the actual government policy of we don't really care, then, you know, if at least someone's come ahead and told the truth for once.
Yes, which is very unusual in the current political environment. But there you go. But I mean, I suppose it's important to stress various trade bodies are campaigning on this. Various artists, musicians, from the superstars all the way down are getting behind this. And it is looking like the entire music community is going to have to get incredibly vocal, sign every petition, send every letter to get any sort of progress on this anytime soon. So we will put links to where you can give your support in the notes for this edition of Setlist.
And finally, on this edition of Setlist, let's talk about Spotify's discovery mode, because everyone likes talking about that. There's been a lot of talk about it since it was announced last year. And last week, unusually, people were saying nice things about it.
Yeah, and nice things on the record.
Yes.
Because I suppose we should add, although there has been quite a lot of criticism of discovery mode, in a moment Andy will explain what discovery mode is for those of you who've forgotten. But although there has been quite a lot of criticism for discovery mode, including, you know, formal criticism through statements from various organizations, and in the US, it's even gone political. Behind the scenes, there are some people who have actually been saying, we actually think discovery mode is a good idea. We think it's a decent bargain that is being offered by Spotify. We can't wait to start using it. So it's not that the entire music community has been anti this idea from Spotify called discovery mode, but it has to be said, the people actually speaking in public about it to date have tended to be of the critical kind. So it was interesting to see two music distribution companies representing independent artists and independent labels officially going on the record for a press release issued by Spotify, basically saying discovery mode is great.
Yeah, so discovery mode, which Spotify began piloting last year, allows artists and labels to choose which tracks get pushed into the Spotify algorithm, which it then spits out into its own automatically generated playlists and personalized radio and other autoplay functions on the streaming service. But in return for choosing which tracks the algorithm picks up on, they have to accept a lower royalty rate on any streams that are generated through that process. And for many artists and labels, that doesn't seem like a very good deal. A lot of people have likened it to payola on the radio, where people paid to have their tracks played on the radio rather than having them chosen because they were any good. So since Spotify announced it last year, it has generated a lot of controversy and a lot of negative coverage.
Yeah, and that comparison to payola comes up a lot, doesn't it? And of course, in many countries, payola, paying radio stations to play your music, is illegal. It's against broadcasting regulations, and it's caused all sorts of trouble throughout the history of record industry in the days when radio play was key. So as you say, lots of people have been critical about this idea of discovery mode and the fact that you have to accept this royalty discount. In terms of organisations and people who've specifically gone on the record with their criticism, the Pan-European Trade Body for the Independent Music Community, that being Impala, although it didn't specifically name and shame Spotify discovery mode, it did in a white paper it published earlier this year about various debates ongoing in the streaming sector, encourage the entire music sector to stand with Impala to reject any proposals by services that reduce royalties for plays or privileged treatment in algorithms or other features, because this is payola and it has no legitimate place in improving viability and opportunity for creators.
So that's in Europe, but over in the US, the Artists' Rights Alliance said in May that artists must unite to condemn this thinly disguised royalty cut. It then added, if Spotify wants to genuinely partner with artists and labels on playlists, priorities, and listener recommendations, it should start by sharing basic information about the algorithms and data powering those processes. Transparency would allow creators to make informed choices and pursue commercial success on the platform in a straightforward way, rather than the current game of digital blind man's bluff creators are forced to play.
Now, I mentioned in the US that this had even gone political. So recently, two members of US Congress, Jerry Nadler and Hank Johnson, sent a letter to Daniel Ek, the boss of Spotify, expressing all sorts of concerns about Discovery Mode. It was very clear that they'd read the statement issued by the aforementioned Artist Rights Alliance, because pretty much all of the concerns that these two Congress members raised very much echoed what had been put in the ARA's statement. But they said to Ek, at a time when the global pandemic has devastated incomes for musicians and other performers, without a clear path back to pre-pandemic levels, any plan that could ultimately lead to further cut pay for working artists and also ultimately lead to potentially less consumer choice raises significant policy issues, they wrote in their letter.
But as we said, despite all of that, there are some people in music marketing who reckon that Discovery Mode could actually be a valuable new promotional tool. And those people see it not so much like payola, but more like when retailers are offered a discount in return for getting CDs stocked in a more premium position in a record shop, as was particularly routine in the CD era. And Spotify itself has insisted that despite the lower royalty rate, artists who have participated in its ongoing pilot of Discovery Mode have seen an overall royalty boost, and labels have seen an average of 30% growth in streams when they've used this new system, meaning that they've made more money overall despite the lower rates paid on those streams.
Yeah, and at Spotify's big Stream On event, which you may remember, I'm sure we talked about it on Setlist, it was that event back in February where pretty much everybody who works at Spotify stood up and said something, or at least it felt like that if you were watching it. And one of the people who stood up talked about Discovery Mode and said how, yes, the people who've been involved in the pilot, they've seen an uplift in their streams, which means that even though, yes, they may be getting less per stream because of the discount, they're making more money overall. One artist and one music company in particular was held up as a case study back at that event. So that was Odie, who works with the distribution company Empire in the US. And Spotify claimed that by using Discovery Mode, Odie had achieved a 69% audience growth and 75% royalty increase as a result of using Discovery Mode to mess with the algorithm.
So that was one case study to get the ball rolling. Last week, Spotify published a whole load of new stuff. So another case study and a load of testimonials from artists and labels all saying, oh yeah, we've been using Discovery Mode and it's really great. Why don't you stick that in a Spotify press release, please? None of them said that in the quote, but they were all thinking it.
It was heavily implied.
So one of the things published was a case study on the artist Natalie Perez, who works with Believe. She's from Argentina, and Spotify says that Discovery Mode allowed her to grow her audience beyond Argentina, and particularly in North America. So they're saying it's really good for expanding your audience. And actually, they said that Perez's team turned Discovery Mode on for 33 tracks over a period of 3 months and saw 14 tracks perform exceedingly well, which helped Perez grow her daily listening base in the US and Mexico by 57% across Spotify. And results like this, Spotify says, are why Believe is backing Discovery Mode. And its CEO, Denis Lardigallery, is quoted by Spotify as saying, "The democratizing power of Discovery Mode will enable a wider community of artists to benefit from boosting their music. It's helping artists cross borders, especially ones from territories that historically haven't had equal access to the global music industry stage. And in these early tests, we're already witnessing how Discovery Mode is helping talented Believe artists from all over the world find their next fans. Spotify is building tools and resources that ensure success is no longer limited to a select few."
The other thing that I think Spotify are trying to push is that, yes, in essence, this is a paid-for promotional service, but surely, this is Spotify speaking now, accepting a royalty discount is better than having to pay an upfront fee. And so in Spotify's brain, even if this is not an opinion that is held by many in the music community, but in Spotify's brain, they're being really nice by making this available through a discount rather than charging you for it. And crucially, as a result of that, they would argue, this isn't just a marketing tool available to the major record companies. It's available to everybody, including self-releasing artists. And some of the artists who gave testimonials last week are actually self-releasing DIY artists, some working with TuneCore, which obviously is owned by Believe, but is more aimed at self-releasing artists, and then also TuneCore's competitor, DistroKid. So we had artists from both of those services saying, yeah, I've been involved in the pilot. It's really helping me as a DIY artist. This isn't just for major record companies. And the fact that I don't have to pay for it up front means I can take advantage of it, because if there was a fee, I wouldn't be able to. Spotify is brilliant, is basically the takeaway from all of these quotes. And not only did we have some DIY artists giving testimonials, but we also had the bosses of both TuneCore and DistroKid basically echoing the mantra here, which is, shut up, everybody. Discover Mode's brilliant.
Yeah, I suppose the issue and one of the concerns that have been raised by critics of this, beyond just saying it looks like payola, is that what happens when everyone is using it? It can't be successful for everyone if every single artist on Spotify puts forward their tracks and accepts a royalty discount. If everyone uses it, then everyone's just getting discounted royalties. So are there safeguards in place to make sure that doesn't happen?
And I suppose the degree to which that concern is justified does depend a little bit on how it works, because maybe Spotify would say, although it's crucial to say that Spotify hasn't really answered that criticism as yet,
no.
Although maybe they will in responding to these Congress members, because it was one of the questions they put in their letter to Daniel Ek. But I suppose what Spotify might say is, by using Discovery Mode, it's not that you put your track above a competing artist's track in our algorithm priority list. It's that it puts specific tracks that you've released above other tracks you've released so that our algorithm can be pushing music at the same time you're pushing them. So maybe you're doing some social media activity, or you've got a new video on YouTube related to the track, or maybe you're on tour and it's your encore track, or, you know, something like that. There's some reason why it's not that we're going to give you priority over another artist. It's that we're going to give your track A priority over your track B. Might be their justification for that concern that, well, surely if everybody uses this, no one will get a benefit. Although that artist putting 33 tracks into Discovery Mode sort of suggests that it's not quite as strategic as picking one track that you're prioritizing at the moment and making sure the algorithm knows about it. So who knows?
Yeah, so what Spotify was saying there really was that Natalie Perez has put 33 tracks into Discovery Mode, and less than half of them have been successful. Although I suppose they did choose their words carefully. They said 14 tracks performed exceedingly well. That doesn't say that the other ones didn't perform well. So maybe they were all successful in their own way. But it does sort of read like, yeah, some of them did all right.
And it has to be said, even if you do side with Believe and TuneCore and DistroKid and some music marketing people who I know who are really good music marketing people who say that actually, this is quite a good idea, and they can see a definite tangible benefit, I would still endorse what the Artists' Rights Alliance said, even if we're not backing their criticism of Discovery Mode specifically. I think I'm agnostic on this at the moment. I haven't made my mind up. But I think it's definitely true to say that there is a general lack of transparency about how the algorithm works in general and how things like this work. And I know that with technology companies, there's always an element of secrecy about algorithms, partly because the algorithms are constantly changing, partly because they're so bloody complicated it'd be really hard to explain, partly because they don't want their competitors knowing what they're doing when it comes to things like music discovery. But I think there is a general lack of transparency in this domain. And of course, there's a lack of transparency in everything to do with streaming and digital music. But whereas I think in the past, when we've talked about the need for more transparency, we've often been talking about transparency regarding the deals that have been negotiated in streaming and what happens to the money as it flows through the system, I think increasingly those transparency calls are going to be more about how does the algorithm work? How does Discovery Mode work? What can people be doing organically to influence the algorithm? And it would be good, even though I acknowledge that maybe this is a big ask, but it would be good if artists and labels at all levels could have a little bit more guidance on that stuff from Spotify. Who knows? Maybe Daniel Ek will tell us all when he replies to those Congress members.
Yeah, or maybe he'll just get Natalie Perez or someone from Believe to write on his behalf. But we'll have to wait and see, because that's all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. Do remember to subscribe to the show. If you're not subscribing to the show, you should definitely subscribe to the show. You should also rate and review it on Apple Podcasts and, I don't know, anywhere else. Apple Podcasts, that's where the algorithm can make or break your podcast. So give us a rating and a review there. And if you've got anything to tell us at all, anything at all, email us at setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Morton, Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.